and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, in a move to apparently increase the pressure on the Islamic resistance even further, recently we've seen the Palestinian group Hamas's political wing labeled by the UK government as a terrorist group. And the Lebanese resistance group Hezbollah's political faction has also been labeled as a terrorist group by Australia. As both of these organizations defend their people against terrorists, the question to be asked, perhaps, is what is terrorism and who is considered a terrorist by these countries which say they stand against terrorism, but apparently the reality is something else. What does it all mean? Stay with us as we take a look at all of this on Spotlight.
A plot to silence anti-Israel resistance groups. This is what many describe the latest move by Australia and the UK to blacklist Lebanese and Palestinian resistance movements. Canberra announced this decision on Wednesday.
Today I'm announcing my intention to list the base and the entirety of Hezbollah as terrorist organisations under the Criminal Code. Now, listing these organisations sends a very strong message that Australia condemns the use of terrorism to achieve political, ideological or religious objectives.
In 2003, Australia blacklisted Hezbollah's military wing, but Wednesday's decision expanded the list to include the group's political wing, which is a powerful player in Lebanon's politics with seats in parliament and cabinet. On November 19, the British government did the same with the political wing of Hamas, joining the United States, Canada and the European Union in fully banning the group.
And today, I have laid an order in the United Kingdom Parliament to amend Schedule 2 of the Terrorism Act 2000 to proscribe Hamas in its entirety, including its political wing.
The decisions have been slammed by resistance groups, with Hamas calling Britain's move unlawful.
The decision is a crime against the Palestinian people and against its historical struggle. This is a condemnation of our right to defend ourselves. It is a political and ethical mistake and unlawful by Britain, added to its first crime, when they had the Balfour Declaration. This step is to satisfy the occupation.
Hezbollah has also denounced Australia's move. Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah says the decision to blacklist the group will not affect its resolve and determination.
Putting the name of Hezbollah into the list of terrorist organizations may be due to regional developments or parliamentary election. However, such designations will not affect the determination of the resistance, nor the support for it.
Both Hezbollah and Hamas have been fighting against the Israeli regime's occupation of their lands for decades. Hezbollah was established following the 1982 Israeli invasion and occupation of southern Lebanon. The movement drove out Israeli forces from Lebanon in May 2000, though Tel Aviv still occupies parts of Lebanon. Hamas also plays a significant role in defending Palestinian rights against frequent Israeli aggressions. The U.S. has already blacklisted both groups to appease the Israeli regime, which was created and nourished by Washington and its Western allies. Australia, the U.S. and Britain are now in a trilateral security pact and are not the only main suppliers of weapons to Israel, but regularly vote against anti-Israeli resolutions at the UN. Their latest moves have exposed their intentions even further, as they have chosen to support the aggressors at the expense of the victims.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the spotlight from the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign, Mick Napier out of Edinburgh. And historian and journalist Brett Yonkers out of Hasselt.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
thank you both for being with me. Let's start it off with Mick. Mick, your overall perspective, because as was said in the opening and also in the package, I mean, Canada and the U.S. and the EU had for years now actually is said that both these organizations were terrorist organizations. It's interesting. Why do you think the UK and Australia had not done that before, and why have they done it now, in your perspective?
I mean, I can't comment on the precise timing of this. I can only take the long view and say that you asked earlier, what does terrorism mean? In the lexicon of Western governments, it simply means any movement which is opposed to their view of their own interests. Could I remind your viewers, by the way, that the only government in the world which has been found guilty by the International Court of Justice of terrorism was the USA, which way back in 86 was found guilty of supporting a terrorist movement, of illegally blockading the harbours of a sovereign country, Nicaragua, and financing the murder of health workers and education workers and so on by the Contras. If you look dispassionately, let's try that, at the deployment of violence by these governments, we find that they support terrorist organizations. If by terrorism we mean the use of violence to achieve a political goal, which of course every government in the world does, it's just the way the world is. But Britain and America and Australia and Canada, I also have a Canadian passport, have been guilty of the mass extermination of native people simply in order to seize their resources. So why shouldn't they support Israel? Look, Hezbollah fought Israel in 2006. Hezbollah overwhelmingly killed Israeli soldiers. Israel overwhelmingly killed Lebanese civilians. The arithmetic is extremely stark. But one group, of course, in official parlance, is called terrorists. Hamas fight to resist the Israeli plan to take over the entirety of Palestine and to expel every single Palestinian they possibly can. They fight in a way which is in line with international law, which allows for people to resist colonization, yet in the official parlance, they are the terrorists. I mean, it makes no sense whatsoever to any honest observer, but we can only say that Britain and America and Australia and Canada, they take any regime, even one which dissolves its dissidents in acid, even one which carpet bombs civilians and openly talks about the destruction of civilian infrastructure in order to inflict pain on the population. These groups are never called terrorists, but any group, however benign. And we have to remember, six Palestinian NGOs have recently been designated as terrorists simply because they exist. That's the crime in the eyes of Australia and the USA. It makes no sense whatsoever.
Stay with me, Mick. Sorry about that. Let me get Brett in on this conversation. But in the last few years, we've seen increased pressure on all parts of the resistance, whether we're talking about Iran or Syria, Hezbollah, Yemen, or resistance groups in Iraq and elsewhere. All these groups have been the recipient of much political and economic pressure. Why is that the case, and is it indicative, perhaps, of the success of the resistance?
Yeah, they always say that. It's a well-known saying that a cornered wild beast is sometimes the most dangerous, and I think this is exactly what is happening. We see now, over the past few decades, especially ever since the conflict in Syria started, but basically we have seen now for decades a gradual pushback happening across West Asia, across the Islamic world and beyond, in which the imperialist powers are slowly but gradually being pushed back. This is definitely this definitely came to the forefront following the 1979 Iranian revolution and the inspiration that it has offered to a lot of people across the Muslim world and across sectarian divides, Shia or Sunni alike. And we have seen a sort of resurgence in the late 20th century and, of course, in the first two decades of this century, a resurgence of domestic resistance against imperialism and against Zionism. And this is something that has rendered, I believe, which has caused a massive fear among the Zionist entity and amongst their backers and supporters in the West and across the world. And that is the reason why they have been really stepping up their pressure even more. They have been stepping up diplomatic pressure, they have been stepping up military campaigns, and they have been stepping up pressure and bribery across the Islamic world, which we have seen with the so-called Abraham Accords last year, in which countries such as Morocco and Bahrain have decided to officially collaborate with the Zionist entity, something that in many cases they were already doing secretly before, but now made it completely official and on the forefront. And I think the reason for that is that Israel, as has been testified by a former leader of the Internal Security Service of Israel, the Shin Bet, who spoke to a Zionist newspaper a couple of years ago, I believe, this former Shin Bet director said that demographically speaking, when things keep on going like they are right now, Israel will have most likely no future in, let's say, the coming in 30 years or so from now, you were speaking of, in about a generation, simply because of the fact that they are basically running out slowly. They're running out of numeric advantage. They're running out of colonists. They're running out of the population growth of Jewish colonists in Israel in order to take over, numerically speaking, the Palestinian people still living there. So what they feel the need to do is they want to ensure that their vision, their view, that Zionist vision of the world, which has been so omnipresent in Western media, is pushed in the minds of people even more. And that is why they have now ensured that even the normal political wing of Hezbollah and of Hamas are considered terrorist organizations in the UK, in Australia, and of course they already were in the US. And especially when you talk about Hezbollah is a legal, legitimate political party, which is supporting in many ways the current government of Lebanon. Right. So in some ways, designating Hezbollah as a terrorist organization means you designate the entire Republic of Lebanon, basically, as a terrorist organization. That is the where we have gotten to nowadays. That is the insanity that the Zionist propaganda has led us over the past year.
Well, you just mentioned, Brett, the effect of this designation. Actually, that's what I wanted to get into. Mick, as far as the effect of these designations, to these organizations themselves, and also to the people living in these countries, in Australia, in the UK, who actually support these organizations. What does it mean exactly, restriction-wise, Mick?
No, very good point. It means increased repression, and the repression has been escalating for several years now, and as our other guest points out, it's not born of confidence. The Zionist project was launched in order to produce a state by cleaning out the local people, but it would be a state where Jews around the world, in Russia and Poland, could move and feel safe in this place. It would be a lifeboat state. I mean, it was always a con, but look what's happening now. In order for this state, with maybe 6 million Zionist Jews, 7 or 8 million non-Zionist people in Palestine as well, in order for this state to continue, the balancing act that they've carried out for the last few decades is becoming increasingly intricate. They remain surrounded by hundreds of millions of people in the Middle East who are hostile to the Zionist entity, who oppose it, and in order for it to survive, they need to build alliances with dictatorial regimes, the emirs and the sheikhs of the Gulf, the Egyptian regime, the Saudi regime, and so on. And they also need very determined support against the local populations by Canada, Britain, Australia, and so on. So this repression will make it more easy to shut down bank accounts, possibly to put a few more people in jail. But the movement to cleanse the Labour Party of pro-Palestine supporters in Britain has now been spreading for quite some time into academia and elsewhere, and that will continue. But designating an organization as terrorist means that the state can move against people much more quickly. As a Palestine solidarity campaign, we will continue to express our solidarity with Hamas. What Hamas says inside for internal Palestinian politics is no concern of ours. I may agree or I may disagree with their social policies. Their right to resist dispossession, their right to resist a regime which sometimes talks about pushing Gaza back to the Stone Age, where a Minister of Defense used the word Shoah, the Hebrew word for genocide, for Holocaust, he would inflict that upon the people of Gaza. the right of Hamas to resist that is unquestioned in international law and in decent morality. So there will come a clash. Those of us who will continue to support Hamas publicly as a resistance movement will come into conflict with the British government and other people in a similar position worldwide. So this is this fight remains to be won or to be lost. At the moment, the British government and other governments are losing the fight for public opinion. I can't stress this often enough.
Well, let me stop you right there. You just said they're losing the fight for public opinion.
No doubt.
But on the other hand, then we see this type of pressure. We see this type of pressure and ramifications then of such a law, because of course there's jail time now that perhaps someone like yourself in the UK, for example, supporting our Hamas. What does that mean? Because obviously then there's even that external pressure now being put on those supporters to probably curtail that public support.
If I could just add one more point, because
sure.
our other guest has many interesting things to say. They are losing the fight. By their resistance, the Palestinians, the Lebanese, and people around the Middle East are showing that resistance can be successful. The deep unpopularity of the Israeli government needs the protection of British, Canadian, and Australian governments. It's not that they're articulating public opinion. Nothing could be further from the truth. The Zionists, in their intra-Zionist conversations, are well aware of the crisis they face in terms of public opinion across Europe, never mind the Middle East. And this repression will continue. But my own guess is, it's doomed to lose. I think we've faced this repression now in Britain, for example, for many years. Certainly in the USA, where there's a bill has gone through Congress. I think I don't know if it's been implemented, but with $1 million fines and 10-year sentences envisaged for BDS campaigners, I think this is bound to lose.
Okay.
I don't have any crystal ball, but I think they will break their teeth on resistance, because
okay.
I think Palestine, if I can take one more point, is now a British domestic political issue.
Brett, after Israel has once again, I mean, in this year, 2021, waged another bloody onslaught on the highly populated Gaza Strip, killing young and old, destroying high-rise apartment buildings in front of cameras, and basically doing whatever it wanted to live. Now, we see at the same time this type of response from these various governments. But on the other hand, like Mick said, do you think that, of course, we saw with social media and showing these towers being brought down and live on TV, that it's also had a major effect on public opinion as they have seen the actual brutality of the regime that perhaps some of them were not aware of?
I think that is definitely the case, and I think indeed the other guests definitely mentioned that very well and has worded it very well, that this increased Zionist repression is not born of confidence, but it's born of fear and uncertainty. There would be no need to curtail public opinion so much, to curtail free speech so much, if there was no problem for the Zionists to work with. And I think indeed, as you have mentioned, when these conflicts happened, like over the summer, when the bombings of the Gaza Strip happened, and these numerous war crimes, which are nothing new, of course, which have been going on for over 70 years in Palestine, ever since 1948. But the difference now is that thanks in many ways due to social media and due to the accessibility of audiovisual media across the world nowadays, we have ways to circumvent the single viewpoint that the mainstream imperialist media has been spoon-feeding people for so many decades. We see now what is going on. We see what has happened. And of course, there will always be pundits and political commentators and politicians who are trying to justify this. But I think it really speaks to the fundamental humanity of many people. Be they don't have to be Muslim, they don't have to be Arab, but that has no bearing on it anymore nowadays. It speaks to the fundamental humanity of people when we realize that this is a colonial project, that this is Zionism is in many ways a death cult which only strives for the complete ethnic cleansing of a land in order to establish and supplant basically an entirely new population on it, much like what has happened in the establishment of the United States and Australia for for which reason, again, another reason for the United States and Australia to support this project, because for them, for these governments, this is very familiar. This is how their country came to be. But for many people now, you can see what is going on. You can see what is happening. And you see a lot of people nowadays, all over the political spectrum, even in the West itself, people who are left-wing, people who are right-wing, who are rising up now against what they see as a fundamental perversion of international law, of international justice, and also what they see nowadays, more and more people start to wake up to the fact that the national sovereignty of their own country is in many ways being subverted by politicians who dare not speak out for fear of their career, for fear of losing their funding, for fear of committing political suicide. And this is something that a lot of people have starting to understand now, that this is a conflict that is bigger than just one strip of land in Palestine, one strip of land in West Asia. This is an international concept. This is an international struggle against a group of people who believe, in this case the Zionists, who believe that people and have the right to do whatever they want, to get whatever project done and whatever goals met that they want to, and kill anyone they want along the way and break every international norm and every international law they want while trying to get to the goal that they want to achieve. More and more people are starting to understand that this is completely unjustified. You see people rising up in the United States, even in the United Kingdom, people who are not just Muslims, but Christians, even Jews, people who are non-religious, people who are religions and backgrounds, who are starting to rise up and to say and to understand and to say and to voice their opinion that this is an unjustifiable system and that this can no longer go on this way and that Zionism needs to end in order for some amount of peace to finally have a chance in the region.
Well, Nick, I mean, in this world where the entity which continually goes against international law and kills civilians at will and in prison without trial does not have to pay a price and the ones who defend the oppressed are punished, do you think that it is showing people more and more that there is no other option except resistance? You cannot rely on the international organizations, for example, the United Nations, the Geneva Conventions. None of that really has any type of meaning, unfortunately, in this world today. Do you think more and more people are realizing that resistance is the only way, and also looking at the success of the resistance and maybe for themselves also, that this is a sample of direction that they too can go into to resist?
You know, our friend pointed to the value of social media as opposed to what we call the mainstream media. It's extremely disciplined in America and Britain and so on, what people are allowed to learn about. There's real strong and very disciplined management of the news. Despite that, large numbers of people are now outside the control by elites, which has lasted until now. Politics is extremely turbulent. I mean, a sort of pathological example of this is Trump. But it means that people who used to vote in a traditional way for a traditional party are much more the system is much more unstable than it was. People are beginning to be very angry indeed. Part of that is undoubtedly opposition to foreign wars, to aggression by our governments in the Middle East. I just point out, by the way, although he was a monster, Donald Trump, when he first ran for the presidency, he was very critical of Israel. He was very critical of US aid that went to Israel. Now, he changed his tune very quickly in order to get the billionaires' money from the likes of Sheldon Adelson and so on. But when he criticized Israel, it didn't do him any harm at all when he was beginning to rise in the polls. Israel is, because of Palestinian resistance, because of Lebanese resistance, Israel is already, and it's so important to bear this in mind, a pariah state in the eyes of public opinion. That has been remarkably consistent since the EU apologized to Israel for the opinions of its own citizens vis-a-vis Israel. It's simply got better from our point of view and worse from the Israeli point of view.
All right. How, and unfortunately, so out? Sorry to interrupt you, Mick, but we are out of time. I appreciate both of you being with me on this spotlight. Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign, Mick Kanefia out of Edinburgh. Historian and journalist Brett Yonkers out of Housesat. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marcia Hashimi.
insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful. Then did you think that we created you uselessly, and that to us you would not be returned?
The 115th verse of the chapter says, أَفَحَسِبْتُمْ أَنَّمَا خَلَقْنَاكُمْ عَبَثًا وَأَنَّكُمْ إِلَيْنَا لَا تُرْجَعُونَ. What do you think then, that we created you aimlessly, and that you shall not be returned to us? In this holy verse, the Almighty Allah is saying that He does not do anything in vain, and He has created the mankind for a purpose. And having the previously discussed verses in our minds, we would understand that without the hereafter, the life of the world would be useless. And therefore, the aim of creation of man is not peculiar or limited for this world. This verse reflects this truth and becomes a very effective and instructive means to awaken those who are centered on this world alone. This will change their perspective and their focus. It says, أَفَحَسِبْتُمْ أَنَّمَا خَلَقْنَاكُمْ عَبَثًا. Do you think that we have created you aimlessly? وَأَنَّكُمْ إِلَيْنَا لَا تُرْجَعُونَ. And you shall not be returned to us? This short, meaningful sentence or question gives a compelling reason for the reality of the Day of Judgment and the existence of reckoning, which is that if the Day of Judgment were not a reality, this worldly life would remain without purpose. This life has many difficulties. It has many hazards which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has prepared, but they are to be considered as preliminaries and conditions for the life to come. If this short life on the earth was all there had been, all our sufferings, all our struggles here would have been meaningless. They would have been in vain. And this is why the Holy Quran has mentioned some of the purpose of the creation of mankind in other verses of the Holy Quran. For example, when He subhanahu wa ta'ala says, وَمَا خَلَقْتُ الْجِنَّ وَالْإِنسِ إِلَّا لِيَعْبُدُونَ. I created the jinn and humankind only that they might worship me, and through this means they might become perfect and close to me. This is one aim.
Mm-hmm. hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this
series
of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
In other cases, the Almighty Allah says, "Who has created life and death that He may try you? Which of you is best in conduct?" الَّذِي خَلَقَ الْمَوْتَ وَالْحَيَاةَ لِيَبْلُوَكُمْ أَيُّكُمْ أَحْسَنُ عَمَلًا. This is also one of the other aims. Or elsewhere he says, "Except those on whom your Lord has mercy, and for that mercy did He create them." Imam Ali alayhi salam says in this regard, "May Allah have mercy on him who is aware of his value and knows from what place he has come." This is what Imam Ali alayhi salam means. The person who knows where he has come from, the person who knows where he is, and the person who knows where he will go to is the one who is aware of his value. Imam Hussein alayhi salam has said, "Allah has not created His servants but to know Him. Then when they knew Him, they would worship Him. And when they worshipped Him, they would no longer need to worship others." Imam Ali alayhi salam has said, "The world is created for something else, not for its own sake. And this world is a means to achieving the hereafter." And this is why some of us, we should reconsider our own suppositions and perceptions regarding this world. Surely those who seek all of their goals in this world will become world-oriented and world-centered, and they will cling to the earth, as the verses of the Holy Quran says, "But he clung to the earth." وَلَكِنَّهُ أَخْلَدَ إِلَى الْأَرْضِ. May the Almighty Allah help us to be aware of the aims of the creation of the world and prepare ourselves for the day of hereafter. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Goodbye. when faith begins.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavet, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puriza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The All Parties Conference is convened in the commercial hub of Pakistan to condemn the UK's move of declaring Hamas a terrorist organization.
Participants of the conference stressed on the need for unity among Muslims and called on the international community to take serious notice of what they call the unilateral action of the old colonial power, the UK, who gave birth to the Zionist regime in the heart of Muslim world.
The conference was organized by Palestine Foundation of Pakistan, aiming to launch further series of week-long activities across the country.
We are all very much disturbed because of the United Nations and the United States policies about the Palestine and about the Israel. Israel is killing Muslims in all over the Palestine. And they are burning the houses and the colonies of the Muslim and building up the colonies for the Jewish.
It's a clear nonsense because, you know, the Hamas is the only representative of Palestinian. All the organizations, they represented by the peoples, they do not involve in terrorism. The UK and Australian have their own terrorist organization, which was supported by UK. Our terrorists from Karachi is in UK, and they were giving the shelter to them. So this is a nonsense, and we do not accept that, and we condemned it.
The UK's move in November coincided with Balfour Declaration in 1917, when British colonial imperialist power created the Zionist apartheid.
Actually, Israel is defeating. Israel will be no more in the map of world in nearby future. So that's why their creator, especially British government and United States administration, they are worried.
Participants called on the Prime Minister Imran Khan to do more than mere condemnation of the UK's government, that instead of apologizing and correcting its historical wrongs across the world and against the Palestinian people, is supporting the aggressor both in Kashmir and Palestine. Mohammad Turi, Karachi.
The 23rd Mediterranean Exchange of Archaeological Tourism has wrapped up in Paestum, a site in central southern Italy recognized by UNESCO as part of the World Cultural Heritage. The three-day initiative aimed to promote sites and destinations of great archaeological value and increase business opportunities. Some 100 conferences and meetings took place during the international event that has seen the participation of more than 150 exhibitors from 15 countries. Syria was among them, with a stand presenting the current state of the Palmyra World Heritage Site in the Homs province after the destruction by Daesh.
In 2015, Daesh militants seized the modern town of Palmyra first and then ancient ruins nearby. The militants initially promised to leave the sites, temples, and columns untouched. However, those promises went on to be unfulfilled.
Daesh attacked Palmyra's archaeological sites with bulldozers and explosives until 2016. The region of Palmyra was then freed from Daesh by a coalition of Syrian Russian military forces on March 24, 2016. During the Mediterranean Exchange of Archaeological Tourism, an International Archaeological Discovery Award for the most valuable discovery of the year was assigned. The award is named after Khaled al-Assad, the archaeologist of the site of Palmyra who was brutally murdered by Daesh for trying to protect the cultural heritage. Max Civili, Paestum.
Thank you.
in the Yemeni capital Sana'a, Yemen's Prime Minister Abdulaziz bin Habtoura honored the Press TV for its prominent role in standing by the Yemeni people and exposing the cracks of the Saudi-led coalition since the beginning of the war.
I would like to thank Press TV and its crew for standing by the Yemeni people in the face of the war imposed on us. Press TV reveals the truth about the war that has taken place between the axis of resistance and the U.S. proxies in the region. Sana'a is just one of the front lines of this confrontation. We greatly appreciate every effort made by satellite channels that honestly expose the crimes of the Saudi-led coalition and reveal the suffering of Yemenis to the world amid the continuing war and siege imposed by Saudi Arabia.
Participants said the Press TV has always been supporting the Yemeni people and its major role is clear through its continuing existence in the field to keep pace with the advancements of the Yemeni army and the Saudi violations against Yemenis.
Press TV is one of the leading channels that serves as a role model for free media and contributes to the resistance of the Yemeni people. This channel has had a prominent impact on Yemenis by keeping pace with every event, whether the victories of the Yemeni army or the crimes of the Saudi-led coalition. So Press TV deserves to be honored and appreciated by the Prime Minister.
Since the beginning of 2015, Yemenis have been suffering under war and siege imposed by Saudi Arabia. The United Nations describes Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis and says millions of Yemenis, including children, are on the brink of famine.
Observers say Saudi Arabia has used thousands of media outlets to spread its propaganda and mislead the free people of the world about its war crimes in Yemen. Therefore, as observers say, the resistance media outlets should stand together against the Saudi-led coalition media war. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Iran's representative at the International Atomic Energy Agency addresses a virtual session of the IAEA's Board of Governors. Mohammad Reza Ghaibi says the Islamic Republic's first priority at the upcoming talks to revive the nuclear deal, known as the JCPOA, will be the effective and verifiable removal of U.S. sanctions without any further delay and any preconditions.
The principal position of the new government of the Islamic Republic of Iran is that the first priority and issue that should be considered seriously into consideration is removal of all illegal sanctions imposed against Iran after the withdrawal of the U.S. from the deal.
Ghaibi said the U.S. needs to address concerns arising from its 2018 withdrawal from the agreement, the least of which is how its possible future adherence can be relied upon. Iran has also criticized European states for requesting that Tehran implement its commitments under the deal, saying that until sanctions are not removed, it's not reasonable to expect more forbearance from the country. During the previous rounds of talks on reviving the JCPOA, Iran made it clear it wanted all U.S. sanctions, including additional ones imposed under the previous administration of Donald Trump, to be removed. Up until now, Tehran says, the administration of Joe Biden has not only failed to mitigate the U.S. maximum pressure policy, but has actually exacerbated it. Delegates from Iran, the three European states of Britain, France, Germany, plus Russia and China, are expected to resume negotiations on Monday here at Vienna's Hotel Coburg, the same venue where talks to reach the nuclear agreement concluded more than 6 years ago. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah denounced Australia's decision to list the whole group as a terrorist organization, saying it was, quote, a humiliating submission to American and Zionist dictates. In a statement, Hezbollah stressed that such a move will not affect its determination to support any anti-Israeli movement.
The timing is bizarre. The only thing that points to the timing is the visit by Israeli diplomats to Australia. That means that the Australians are abiding by requests by the Israelis. That is what this decision is all about. These are the indicators. Now, what repercussions does this decision have? I think that the Australian diplomats, and let me break it out to you, the Australian diplomats have been trying
in the back door to have to be in touch with Hezbollah to actually say that there are no repercussions.
Australia on Wednesday extended a pre-existing ban on the movement's armed units.
The group continues to threaten terrorist attacks and provide support to terrorist organisations. Hence my intention to list the entirety of Hezbollah.
Observers believe the United States has been exerting all efforts with its allies to demonize Hezbollah, not only in the region, but across the globe.
It seems clear that the U.S. is facing a dilemma in the region, which is Hezbollah, and it is attempting to deal with this dilemma through a political course with Lebanon, in the region and beyond it. When we see that Australia takes such a decision, we can conclude that the U.S. is using all its arms and its tools in all spheres to face Hezbollah in a medium and long-term track.
Analysts agree that this comes only months preceding the Lebanese parliamentary elections in order to intimidate expats from going to the ballots, while it also puts pressure on Hezbollah's allies at home. Sources close to Hezbollah also expect to see similar moves from countries which have taken the U.S. path in their foreign policies. Hezbollah has long been targeted by the U.S., Israel, and their allies, but Hezbollah is a fully functioning political party within the Lebanese parliament and cabinet, and many fear that the recent move by Australia could impact diplomatic ties with Lebanon's government and further destabilize the country. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The Palestinian Center for Human Rights, along with UNRWA and the Palestinian Ministry of Public Works, held a workshop in the Gaza Strip to discuss Israel's latest destruction of hundreds of buildings during the May War. According to the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, OHCHR, over 100,000 internally displaced persons, or IDPs, sought shelter and protection at UNRWA schools or with hosting families. Currently, there are still about 8,000 Palestinian IDPs, primarily those whose houses were completely destroyed or severely damaged during the one-ton Israeli bombardment.
The Israeli war in May caused massive destruction, especially to residential areas, and thousands of families have been internally displaced. The delay of reconstruction is a direct result of the Israeli blockade. Israel bans the entry of building supplies into the Gaza Strip in a direct and grave violation of the international law and the Fourth Geneva Convention.
People and businesses in the Gaza Strip are still waiting for the reconstruction to start. In addition to bombing thousands of buildings and infrastructure, Israeli regime forces also killed hundreds of innocent civilians, including women and children.
It was 7 p.m. on the last day of the holy month of Ramadan when the apartment building where I lived was bombed. Israeli warplanes first fired a drone rocket and minutes later hit the building with an F-16 bomb. My family is currently displaced and we are just lucky to be still alive. We call on all the world to help us rebuild our homes.
Over 2,200 Palestinians were also injured during the Israeli air raids, including 685 children and 480 women, some of whom may suffer a long-term disability requiring rehabilitation. Hundreds of Palestinian families have lost everything during Israel's May onslaught, and their plight has no end in sight.
My house was bombed on the morning of Eid al-Fitr around 5 a.m. It was a horrific scene beyond description. Can you imagine being with your wife and children preparing for the holiday, and all of a sudden your house is bombed and no longer have a place to call home?
Many Gazans had their lives shattered because of the recent war, and they still have no proper place to raise their families. Rights groups accuse donor countries of failing to fulfill their financial pledges to rebuild the tiny coastal territory and end the illegal and inhumane Israeli blockade. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Dozens more souls, including those of a pregnant woman, and several children lost to the sea. More lives lost in a dangerous quest across the English Channel. And even as the recovery efforts continue, the blame game intensified between the UK and France on how this tragedy unfolded and who should shoulder the blame.
I've offered to work with France to put more officers on the ground and do absolutely whatever is necessary to secure the area so that vulnerable people do not risk their lives by getting into unseaworthy boats.
The British Prime Minister was more forthright.
We've had difficulties persuading some of our partners, particularly the French, to do things in a way that we think is the situation deserves.
All these women and men do not want asylum in France. We offer them all. Those who want it are taken care of in the centres made available in Calais and Dunkirk, and we will strengthen the means of rescue at sea. But above all, we need to develop much stronger and more responsible partners.
This is yet another unsavoury chapter for Priti Patel's Home Office. And with the issue of migration, legal or otherwise, firmly linked to the Conservatives' law and order agenda, campaigners are urging the government to depoliticize this issue, seek cross-border solutions that may well save innocent lives.
Everything about how this government has approached the question of cross-channel refugees has been political point scoring and game playing with human lives and people escaping persecution, war and abuse, and subjecting them to criminalization and demonization.
For many campaigners, the connection has to be made between the UK's foreign policy and the refugee crisis.
The truth is that the vast majority of refugees trying to get here are victims of war, and this is from a whole number of countries in which Britain has been centrally involved in these wars.
Boris Johnson has said no option is off the table.
As long as they keep treating this crisis as a crisis of invasion and criminality instead of a crisis of humanity and devastation across the world that is driving people to seek refuge, you are going to have more people die.
Tightening restrictions will mean more dangerous conditions for those hoping to get into Britain by any means necessary. This can only mean more lives lost in the days, weeks, and months to come. Amina Taylor, London.
The United States has always touted itself as a leading democracy in the world. In line with such a narrative, the US is scheduled to hold a so-called summit on democracy next month, but the names of some of the participants and absentees cast doubt on the motive behind such an event. The inclusion of Taiwan, and not China, poses not only a challenge to Washington, but exposes its real intention.
The US action to push forward the group politics and provoke allied confrontations under the cover of democracy is a reproduction of the Cold War mentality, which is widely questioned and opposed by the wise persons in the international community.
Russia, which has also been excluded from the summit, said the meeting is aimed at creating divisions among countries and privatizing the term democracy.
They wish to privatize the very word democracy. In their opinion, democracy is only what corresponds to Washington's understanding of democracy. Obviously, this cannot be so and must not be so. And in fact, it is not.
Another challenge the US faces is its decision to include Israel in the list of over 100 invitees to the virtual gathering. It has put a big question mark to the democratic nature of the event, given the Israeli regime's atrocities and crimes against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip on a daily basis. The administration of President Joe Biden claims the summit seeks to help stop democratic backsliding and erosion of rights and freedoms worldwide. Nonetheless, earlier this week, the Stockholm-based International Institute for Democracy and Electoral Assistance said it is the first time that the U.S. has been added to its list titled Backsliding Democracies. The international think tank also pointed to a, quote, decline in the quality of freedom of association and assembly in the U.S. during the summer 2020 protests after the police killing of George Floyd. Floyd's death once again turned the spotlight on racial bias toward African Americans and other minority groups in the U.S. The support for the Saudi-led war on Yemen and huge arms sales to the kingdom also put a question mark on U.S. claims to be a leading human rights advocate. The U.S. military adventurism has also exposed its real face. Invasions of Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, and some other countries under different pretexts, including fighting terrorism and bringing democracy, have only resulted in the loss of lives of hundreds of thousands of innocent civilians. Sanctions are yet another tool the United States has used for decades against others, including Iran and Venezuela. But the economic warfare has brought suffering to the people in these countries, as they are unable to access the basic humanitarian needs such as food and medicines, leading to the death of many innocent people. Given the humanitarian impacts of U.S. policies and its long-standing support for undemocratic regimes, it remains to be seen how Washington wants to protect democracy in the format of its planned summit.
The International Atomic Energy Agency's Board of Governors convenes a virtual meeting a day after IAEA Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi's trip to Tehran. Addressing the board, Grossi said the extensive negotiations with high-ranking Iranian officials to address outstanding issues had proven inconclusive, but that he would not give up on efforts to come to an understanding.
The talks were constructive. The talks were correct. The talks were professional. So that is one thing, but we could not reach an agreement.
Grossi said the sides must reach an agreement that would allow the agency to access surveillance equipment at Iran's Karaj workshop, warning the IAEA is close to the point where it would not be able to guarantee the continuity of knowledge. Iran says it's conducting a judicial and security investigation at the site following a terrorist attack blamed on Israel and cannot legally allow the agency access while the investigation is underway. Tehran has asked the IAEA to assist in the investigation as the attack destroyed one of the agency's cameras. In a separate report to the board, Grossi also mentioned questions that still need to be clarified about the presence of uranium particles at three locations not declared to the agency. Iran has previously responded by asking the IAEA not to magnify non-urgent issues related to the country's past activities, saying some of the questions are based on unsubstantiated claims and images provided by the country's enemies.
Iranian officials say despite differences of opinion with the agency, efforts will continue to bring the outstanding issues to a final resolution. Iran has also urged other IAEA member states to refrain from adopting any hasty or politically motivated position. Homalezgi, Vienna.
It's envisaged EU leaders and the European Parliament will almost certainly rubber stamp new anti-immigrant proposals put forward by the European Commission on Tuesday. Any airline or ferry company deemed by the EU to be carrying illegal immigrants destined for the bloc will be placed on a blacklist. The Commission accuses Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko of bringing migrants to EU borders in retaliation for sanctions imposed on Minsk.
I think he has missed the game, because what he has got is a new round of sanctions, and now he will have to contribute and to take care of these people.
The European Commission is giving €200 million to EU countries Poland, Lithuania and Latvia for border controls. Poland is already accused of human rights abuses against migrants. Between 10 and 15,000 migrants are still in Belarus. The EU is spending a total of €3.5 million to facilitate their deportation.
We are now ready to accelerate with many more planes coming out of Belarus, and we will mobilize additional funds of around €1 million to support these returns.
It has never been harder for genuine refugees to reach the European Union. Under international law, they are entitled to seek asylum here. Most of them are in countries ravaged by Western war.